This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll talk wine and hear about some differences between working in vineyards in Northern California versus the Central Coast.
In Paso Robles, there's a lot of hills, and I'd be hiking up a mountain. I'd walk 15 miles a day getting fruit samples.
And later, KCBX Morning Edition host Rachel Duchak takes us on a bike ride through Big Sur on the Pacific Coast Highway.
Just pedaling slowly uphill to see this cool rock work. This used to be a rinky-dink road.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's December 16th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Two Central Coast medical librarians want to help the community find accurate health information online. Contributor Beth Thornton sat down with librarians Brittany Haliani and Heather Stevens of Cottage Health in Santa Barbara to discuss Fact or Fiction. That's a free class offering sound advice on sourcing factual and useful health information. Cottage Health's Sage Library in Santa Barbara is unique in that it's open to the public and staffed by librarians willing to assist you with health-related research in person or online.
Brittany, you're the manager of library services. Describe your job for us. Tell us what's different about being a medical librarian versus another type of librarian.
The training's different. So my training has only been in medical libraries. I've never worked in another library besides medicine. When I got my graduate degree, I specifically went to a graduate school that specialized in medical librarianship. And then my training is as a clinical medical librarian, which means I participate in daily rounding with the residents, the attendings, the nurses. And so as questions are asked during clinical rounding with patient care, they have instant access to evidence-based medicine.
You're interacting with doctors, nurses. Are you also interacting with family members and the public?
Yes, we are. The public is less because the medical library is a clinical library, so its sole purpose really is to be providing medical information so that we can take care of our patients. But as a bonus, we open it up to the public. And so yes, we also interact with the public when they have a diagnosis or they want to look up something specific for a family member or they're interested in something such as that.
Recently started offering a class called Fact or Fiction. What prompted the need for the class?
It's a twofold answer. One is, as medical librarians and we're culling through the information, we come across often with inaccurate information, or we can see as we're looking through databases or just generally looking through Google, you can see that there is a lot of information out there and it's inaccurate. And so Heather and I sat down and I said, wow, there's a lot of information here. How do people decide? Because you and I are trained to know what is a good website or a good resource, but what does everyone else do? So that was the first part that started it. Then we started seeing the public come in. And they were asking us questions about, oh, I have this supplement that I read about in the news and I want to look up information on that. And as we're helping them look up the information, we are seeing as health information professionals that this isn't good. This information, this supplement or this treatment that they either heard from a friend or they heard on social media is not accurate. And perhaps maybe we need to do some community outreach to teach people how to decipher what is good health information and what is bad information.
Who is your intended audience for the class?
Anyone. I think it's for anyone clinical, it's anyone non-clinical, it's for your grandmother, it's for your sister, it's for your mom, it's for your best friend. So I think it's anyone who needs to find reliable health information on the internet.
Give us an idea of the most common questions you hear from people who are trying to find information online.
So it's often a newly diagnosed person. So we have someone who might come in and say, you know, my husband's just been diagnosed with a brain tumor, and I need to find everything about that particular disorder, and I need to make some informed decisions. So that would be one type of patient. Or patron. They don't even have to be a patient of ours. They can just be someone in the community.
What are the types of things we need to know when we log on trying to find healthcare information?
I think number one is going to a reliable website. And what that means is going to any site that ends in .gov, it ends in .edu, any hospital system will have reliable information. Specifically, the best website that I think that is available out there is Medline Plus, which is through the National Institutes of Health, more specifically the National Library of Medicine, which is the largest medical library in the world. And they are dedicated to provide reliable health information. And the reason why it's so great is they go through all the different websites and then they put what is reliable on one particular medical subject on one page. So you're going to get information, for instance, on diabetes from the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control, the American Diabetes Association, the American Academy of Family Physicians. And so you know when you're looking on that website that I don't have to guess, is this reliable? Is this good information? You just know by going to that website that you're going to get lots of resources and from many different reliable websites.
Tell us the name of that website again.
It's Medline Plus. And the website is medlineplus.gov. That's the actual URL for you to look online. And it's free.
Explain a little bit about the difference between something being peer-reviewed or a certain affiliation that maybe the author should have, if it's a doctor. It may be some of the differences that people might want to look out for.
Peer-reviewed is where you have experts that are looking at the information, and then they're formulating a consensus on whether they think something is good or not. So that would be a peer-reviewed journal, a peer-reviewed article. And so what happens is it goes through vigorous editing and someone looks at that article or journal, and then you have many people who are giving their opinion on whether they think it is authoritative or not. Most reliable websites are going to have an editorial board. So that would be your peer review. You look and they say, this is the editorial board. So if you looked at mayoclinic.com or you look at the National Library of Medicine's Medline Plus, there is an editorial board on there that is consistently looking at the content and they are reviewing it and they're also dating it.
Heather, can you describe some of the ways people can recognize credible sources versus sales pitch or inaccurate claims?
You want to look at who is writing the article. Are they themselves an expert? If not, are they citing experts? Are they talking to experts? Are they quoting them? Are they linking to studies that are published somewhere that we can check? If they're a physician, you can check their credentials. You can look up and see if they have a medical license. If not, ask why they're speaking on this topic. Why is this person telling me this information? Is it to actually help me take care of myself better, to inform me? Or is it to persuade me to believe a certain way or buy a certain product? Is it something you can verify with a second source? If you find a good, reputable website like Medline Plus or from the Mayo Clinic, you know, is what you're reading, does that fit with and can it be verified by these more authoritative websites?
What about vague references, the ones that state, take this today and you're going to feel great tomorrow?
A lot of articles or product advertisements or descriptions will mention studies show or scientists have found, and then they don't give you the specifics. If you're saying studies show, I want to see what studies. I want to see the physicians who did the studies, what organization, what institution. If studies really do show, then, you know, show your work, provide a link.
Brittany, tell us how our listeners can find the classes.
We don't have anything scheduled for the rest of 2019. However, our goal for 2020 is to reach out to the Santa Barbara Public Library, reach out to other local memberships to provide this class for, whether it's a Rotary Club or a book club, that we will schedule those and take this talk out on the road. But I would say the best place to find what's going on here at Cottage Health is to go to our website, which is cottagehealth.org, and anything that we are going to be scheduling for 2020, we will definitely post on our health website.
Tell us about the Sage Medical Library.
The Sage Medical Library is a brand new library opened 3 years ago, and it is open to the public. And interesting enough, we are one of the only hospital libraries open to the public in the United States. You can come in there and you can look up medical information. There are the librarians there to help you. I cannot say enough great things about this design of the library. It really was designed for collaboration, for people to have different areas of where they feel comfortable to study or look up information. We specifically designed an area that has two computers that the public can come in and access health information in there. Unfortunately, there is seismic construction that is going around the library. So the library itself is not under construction, but the space around it is. And so we have been moved to a temporary space, and that space is very small. So unfortunately, we did have to close to the public while the construction is going on. However, we do offer email assistance, or you can call the library, and we're more than happy to assist anyone who reaches out to us. And they can do that through our cottagehealth.org website.
This is the largest medical library between San Francisco and Los Angeles?
It's the largest and I think the only medical library between Los Angeles and San Francisco, yes. It goes back to that old adage of knowledge is power. And it's so true in health information, because if you're newly diagnosed, there's so many unknowns. And if you can have some information that can help you make an informative decision or help you understand what that diagnosis is, I just can't think of anything better for someone to walk away with.
Brittany Haliani and Heather Stevens, thank you very much for joining me. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
My name is Dan Pinella. I am the director of winemaking and co-owner at Oak Farm Vineyards. We're in Lodi, California, and this is a family-owned deal, and we've been doing this now for almost 10 years.
Family roots go back
about 100 years, yeah, exactly.
So that's how you were able to do what you guys do
100%.
Today.
100%, and this is something that built up over 100 years where my family has been farming and agricultural trucking, and has helped be able to produce this place, yeah.
Today, your title is your daily duty?
Director of winemaking, co-owner, and I do a lot of the sales and out on the road, too.
So. And you went to Fresno State?
I actually just did some stuff at UC Davis. It's a lot of learn by doing.
That's the best.
Yep.
And you went to Cal Poly.
Yes. My name is Sierra Zider. I was born and raised in Lodi and actually went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo for oenology.
So you knew what you wanted to do when you went there?
Yes. I was about 15 when I realized I wanted to be a winemaker.
And your family connection here is?
I actually have no family in agriculture. Most of my family...
You're not related?
No, I'm not related to Dan. Mm-hmm. Just born and raised in the area and knew of Oak Farm when I was growing up here. And when I went to college, I'd come back and visit Oak Farm, and then got the opportunity to come and work for Oak Farm, which has been an amazing opportunity.
So rolling back in time, when you were at Cal Poly, is that when you worked at Dow and J.Lohr?
Yes. So Cal Poly has you do internships when you're in oenology. And so I took all of my fall quarters off and did an internship. The first one was here in Lodi, and then I did one Dow Vineyards and Winery. And then I did the next one at J.Lohr.
So a lot of contrast between the growing practices here and, say, Dow, for example.
Yeah.
It's environmental, right?
Yeah. Lodi is a more Mediterranean climate, and we're very flat. We don't have hills, but Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, and in Paso Robles, there's a lot of hills. So, you know, I would check the vineyards and walk the vineyards and fruit sample, and I'd be hiking up a mountain. I'd walk 15 miles a day getting fruit samples. Whereas here, it's a straight shot. There's no uphills, there's no downhills. And weather-wise, I would say Paso might get a little bit hotter because we in Lodi have the influence of the Delta and the McCollumee River for some breezes.
And what do you focus on now here?
So I am one of the winemakers here. And
how did that happen? You knew at Cal Poly you wanted to be a winemaker and not out in the field?
Yes. At Cal Poly you do a lot of learn by doing, which was our motto. And so, I mean, I did a lot of pruning in the vineyard and looking at grapes and all the varieties, but I love science and blending flavors together to create something. Mm-hmm. And so I fell in love. I actually started as wine business and then decided my freshman year that, you know, I love my chemistry class and my marketing class is all right, but I think this is my strong suit in the sciences. And so immediately switched to enology.
When you look back at your time, the whole process being at Cal Poly, what are you most indebted about? You know, what's your takeaway that served you well?
I would say, and I just mentioned this, the motto, learn by doing. Because my first class ever at Cal Poly was to go in the vineyard, and they said, here's pruning shears, go prune the vineyard. And, you know, I was 18 at the time. I had no ag in my family. I was like, what am I supposed to do? And they put you in the situations and teach you. You know, they have a winery on campus, and so we would hook hoses together. We'd learn how to use a filter. Whereas we weren't just learning it in a book. They weren't showing me pictures of a filter. I actually saw it in person, got to use it. So I think it was very good because it wasn't just learning by a book, it was actual experiences. And they make you have internships. And you know, me having 3 internships, 4 internships prior to coming to Oak Farm, I was more beneficial to Oak Farm.
Yeah, I mean, it was something that we can say that we've had other people come from other schools and talk to us. And just like she said, they didn't even know how to hook up a pump or a filter or had any firsthand experience. It was primarily just all head knowledge and not any kind of practical work. And so that was something that anytime that we've been looking for other people, a place that has a model like Cal Poly, and same thing with some of the other schools that are out there too, is something that we look for where they actually have hands-on experience. It's a huge thing for us.
That could put you in the head of the list for a hire.
No doubt. At least for us, especially now having...
So if you see a Cal Poly grad, you're going to have your attention.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I seriously have a different... They would go higher up on the stack in terms of people, for sure.
So when you're at Cal Poly, you did spend time in the fields and field management and whatnot. Do you continue that? Even though you're a winemaker in the lab, are you still out there biting the seeds?
Yeah, I would say that the first thing to winemaking is growing the grapes. I think if you start with amazing grapes, you're going to make amazing wine. And so me and Dan are out there almost every day the month before harvest, walking the rows, tasting the grapes, running numbers, running the sugar level, running the pH level.
So you, as much as Dan might make that decision to harvest.
Yes. Right. It's usually both of us together. We look at the numbers, but it's
so
not...
So your number more just confirming what your taste is telling you?
And like, you got to base it off of taste. When you're tasting, the flavors are finally ripe. Like in a Sauvignon Blanc, you're tasting that green apple. You're tasting some of that mango. You know there's a switch. There's a day switch between the flavors.
So it totally is taste ruling. Let's say that it came in the lab at 26 bricks, let's just say. But yet, in your taste, it was like, oh my God, this is perfect.
Yeah.
It doesn't, the numbers are not going to influence you.
Correct. Yeah. Like you said, the numbers are just to kind of confirm. And then there's a couple times where if the grape has a little bit more acid, it'll trick your brain into thinking there's not as much sugar as there is and all that kind of stuff. So you have to kind of verify and all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, it is just years of experience of knowing what it tastes like when it's ripe. I think going higher, more on numbers when you're less experienced makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And that sugar acid intersection balance help you to confirm?
Yes, 100% helps us confirm our tasting. But I think if it tastes good, it's going to make good wine. But you need to have the right numbers as well for alcohol percentages and for not adding too much acid to the wine later on, things like that.
Do you guys ever do native yeast fermentation?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then one of those things is that's where numbers actually come into a higher play for us, because then we'll look at, we'll run and see how much yeast assemblable nitrogen is in the grapes to be able to know if the yeast is going to be able to finish out fermentation.
Or shut down
and all that kind of stuff, because we don't want a stuck fermentation with a sweet wine. And so those are definitely things that you got to look at, and that's where numbers are super helpful and something that you wouldn't get off of taste, for example.
And Dan and I really believe in having some native fermentations in a lot of our varieties. I think it adds complexity and it adds some body and mouthfeel that you can't get from controlling the fermentation and using a commercial yeast. So we usually split the tanks up and do, like, you know, half of it commercial yeast and half of it native.
Some winemakers, they talk about the characteristics that are imparted in the wine via the yeast that you introduced.
We really do a lot of experiments with yeast trials. So we'll take the same lot of grapes and the same lot of juice and split it up into three tanks and use three different commercial yeasts. And it is crazy how much the tanks taste different based on the characteristics of this yeast. And if, you know, if they're going to present more thiols or more pyrazines or, you know, different characteristics to the wine.
That's really cool. We could go on forever and ever. Before we go, Cal Poly, do you ever get back over there? Do you ever reconnect with your professors?
Yeah, I actually have a lot of good friends from Cal Poly. And so two of them got married, so I've gone back, and they've had their weddings there. So I've gone back a couple times, and I've reached out to a couple of professors, one being Federico Casassa, and he was one of my favorite teachers. He taught winemaking 1, 2, and 3 my senior year. And
in what year did you graduate?
In 2017. And he just really got the students, and he made it hard because he made you know, he went step by step through, you know, from picking decisions all the way to bottling. And he did every single thing that you would think of as a winemaker, he showed you, and he made you learn. So it was a hard class.
But you're indebted today.
Yeah. I still pull up his slides sometimes and look at them when I have a decision I have to make at Oak Farm. But a lot of the teachers I definitely have stayed in touch with and have contacted or, you know, tried to get interns through them for Oak Farm.
Bring them over here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you guys for sharing.
Yeah,
appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Oh,
you guys. If somebody want to learn more about Oak Farm Vineyards.
Yeah. So, again, this is Dan Pinella, and you go to just oakfarmvineyards.com. Real simple.
I want to thank you guys, and my name is Sierra Zider.
And I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Lodi, California. We'll see you here.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll get to know a Central Coast businessman and former president of the San Luis Obispo Rotary Club, who shares his experience as a child growing up in Norway during the Nazi occupation.
So young people, if they could, if they were out and about, they weren't just normally mischievous, but they were mischievous in a special way to make the Germans a little less welcome.
Yes.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas.
Hello, this is Brian Mendels for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Per Matt Matheson, local businessman and educator and good friend of mine, also a local Rotary Club member. Welcome, Matt.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a real treat to have you here for many reasons. For years, I was a customer of your business, Matt's Brake and Alignment.
Yes.
And even now, as we know, I come to you for advice about things automotive. I know that you also have been the host of a radio program about automobile repair issues, a local version of Click and Clack.
No, I would say that we didn't try to emit after them because I felt that they were a little sarcastic,
uh-huh.
And I didn't like that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But that was the 21 years.
21 years.
Every Saturday for 1 hour.
And what was the name of the show?
There was the Motor Mouths.
Motor Mouths, and
yes.
It was kind of like Hick and Clack, but without the snark.
Yeah, without the snark, yes. I'm a Norwegian.
Yes, Matt.
That means I'm from Norway.
Matt, could you tell us a little bit about where you were born and how you got to be here in San Luis Obispo today, briefly?
Okay, I was born in Norway, outside Oslo. That was the capital of Norway, in 1931. It was a hard time. My dad was working in radio. He worked for a radio company that was building radios. When I was 3 years old, my mother and father moved to Drammen, which is about 30 miles from Oslo. And she took over a store that was run, milk and bread store, that was run by my grandmother. And I grew up in that town. In 1940, the Germans invaded Norway. I was 8 years old. Things changed quite a bit. My dad was in the military at that time. He was on what they call a military duty. He was going to go to America because he had a patent. And they had to do military duties before. That was the second time in the military before they could leave the neutrality duty, he called it. And
neutrality duty, okay.
Yeah, neutrality duty. So, but as a kid, Germans took over our schools. We had big schools. It was a nice place for the Germans for their troops to stay in. We had to find, they had to find other locations for school, and that was hard. So school was hard to come by.
So the German troops took over school facilities and classrooms for their lodging and other duties, and so the teachers and the students had to go elsewhere.
Yeah, and the teachers, they were told either to join the Nazi party or they got shipped up to northern Norway to build fortifications.
Wow, so the teachers themselves had to join the Nazi party or be exiled to the far north to do maybe basically slave labor.
Yeah. And so the only ones that was spared, of course, from that was the old teachers, very old ones, the ones that was ready to retire. It was a hard time. And of course, then in the spring, we had to go out and help the farmers. And in the fall, we had to go out and help the farmers. But it was a good time for young people. We could do whatever we wanted was wrong against the Germans or against the Nazis. We could steal and As long as he didn't get caught. If we get caught, then of course we wouldn't be the ones that would be taken to jail, but our parents would be.
Young people, if they could, if they were out and about, they weren't just normally mischievous, but they were mischievous in a special way to make the Germans a little less welcome.
Yes. We had to go by some railroad tracks and some railroad cars to go to school, for example. And we put our hands full of sand in the bearing boxes on the wheels on those railroad cars.
Yeah, bearings and sand don't go together, do they?
No.
Yeah.
And I mean, we would steal if we could find something to steal.
Did your parents know about that?
No.
Uh-huh. They probably would have been terrified if they did.
Oh. Well, yeah, we didn't tell them so much.
Your dad was in the Norwegian military.
He came home about 5 days after the war started. They sent him home.
And so he wasn't arrested or sent away?
No. He was just a private.
I see.
No, when the officers got sent to prison camps in Germany.
I see. So, yeah, he was an enlisted man then, and he was safe from that fate.
Right.
Now, you were a child then growing up in Norway throughout until the Nazis were defeated in 45?
Yeah. And then my dad then went to the United States for a couple of years to develop the patent he had. And decided to go to the United States, move to the United States. I served in the Norwegian Army, occupation duty in Germany, in what they call a brigade, in the English occupation zone.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, one night I came home, my dad asked me if I wanted to go to the United States tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes.
Wow.
And the next day I was sitting on the airplane to the United States.
Were you an only child? Did you have brothers and sisters?
No, I had an only child. Yeah.
Going back to your dad, was the patent about radios? And
no. The patent was about a card fighting system where he used magnetic force to separate the cards in the box where the cards are sitting.
Uh-huh.
So each card had a small piece of steel sitting in the top left, right, and left corner, and there was a magnet in the side of the box. The card fighting system was called Magnadex.
Magnadex.
And so that the cards would separate themselves if you gave them room.
I see. Now, what was on the cards? What kind of information?
No, I mean, it was the card you filled out. I mean, the card that you used for you.
For whatever.
What you put in, yes.
I see. Was he successful with that? Or?
Well, he was doing fairly good, but he was not doing very good.
Understood. No. Well, so you, where did you land when you got to the United States?
I came to New York.
Uh-huh.
Now, before in Norway, half a year before I went in the military, I met a girl in Norway. She was an American citizen. Her parents had been to Tacoma, Washington. Her father had been a minister at the church there. And she had to go back to the United States before she was 21 to keep her citizenship. And so I had met her. And so she had gone then back to New York. And when I came to New York, I met up with her. And after a couple of years, we got married.
Oh, yeah, that's great. And I know you had a long marriage and a grown daughter, I believe.
I got two daughters.
Two daughters. Yeah. Any grandchildren?
Nope.
How did you sort of seek and establish your profession as an automotive mechanic specialist?
Well, while I was in Vermont, I got a job in a Chevrolet garage, and I was doing lube work and washed cars and so forth. And I went to school at night, and the teacher there was a man that was the son of a man that had an alignment shop, wheel alignment shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never heard about that before. You know, I didn't know what it was, but I got very much interested in it, and I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got drafted in the American Army, and I spent 2 years in the American Army. And
what era was that? What
56,
time?
56. 56 to 58.
So that was a peacetime, more or less, peacetime?
Yeah, that was right after the Korean War. I was able to stay out of the Korean War. I didn't want to go back to anything like that again.
And so how did you wind up in California?
I was in the 1st Armored Division in Fort Polk, Louisiana, and they mothballed the 1st Armored, brought that down to brigade, that shipped the part of us out to Camp Roberts.
Uh-huh.
And so I was at the sea deck at Camp Roberts, served out my last three-quarter of a year there.
And what's a CDEC?
CDEC was Combat Development and Experimental Center at Hunter Leggett's. And that how they was experimenting on what to do in future wars.
Right. I think it's fascinating that so much of our county and Southern Monterey County have a military history. What prior to World War II were dairy farms is now a community college, but also a National Guard base.
Yep.
And then you've got Hunter Leggett and Camp Roberts, all of which are still active military bases for training and so forth. So how did you then get started with your own business?
As I was living in Atascadero, I rented a house in Atascadero, my wife, Mary, and then after I got discharged from the military, looking for a job, I went down to San Luis Obispo to look for something. I found Todd's Alignment, 307 Higuera Street.
Okay.
And went in there. He was by himself doing alignments, very good alignment man. And I got a job. So I worked for him for 3 years. And then I decided he was going to go someplace else. And his brother was going to take over the shop. So I decided to start my own business. I found a used alignment machine, and I bought a used wheel balancer. And I found a place to rent at 1185 Monterey Street and open up. Working for Todd, see, I had worked for everybody in town, more or less. All the body shops and most of the dealers that didn't have their own alignment business and so forth. So I figured that I was known to them as a man that could do the work and so forth.
I'd like to remind everyone that this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local businessman and educator, pair Matt Matheson. It's so wonderful to speak with you. I'd like to shift gears now, pun not intended, and talk about your career in education. You're teaching people through the Motor Mouth shows in the past, proper auto maintenance, but you also teach classes locally, and you were a trustee at Cuesta College.
Well, that started, you know, when they first opened up Cuesta College, they had to have some advisory board for the automotive technology department at Cuesta, and I was invited into that. So I got on the advisory board, helped out where they needed. They needed, for example, old parts that we had for their classes, so they had something for the students to work on. After that, what happened is I had one man working for me that I sent to Cuesta College to go to alignment class. And I said, when he came back, and how was that? And he was telling me what they had learned. And I said, well, that's not right. So I said, I better go out and take a look at this. I'll sit in on the class.
You're the kind of shy and retiring type.
So I went out and sat in the class, and of course the teacher saw me come in, and he knew who I was, and he had me start talking.
Uh-huh.
And then pretty soon he says, okay, you want a job?
Wow.
And I said, well, I don't have a teaching credential. He said, we'll give you time to get one. So I start teaching part-time in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to school in Santa Barbara for a year, evening classes, and I went to Cal Poly for a while. And I got my lifetime teaching credential, something that they don't have anymore.
Right.
And so I taught at Cuesta College and for about 7 or 8 years part-time, and I got into half-time for a little bit. And then I gave up on that. And so then I didn't do any teaching for a while, and was in the business. In the meantime, I Cuesta College, because I was on the advisory board, I knew that the vocational education at Cuesta College was going downhill very, very badly. They didn't seem to be interested in vocational education at all. They wanted to take and get transfer students to Cal Poly. That was number one. And of course, I belonged to an organization of independent garage owners. And so we had a whole bunch of about 40 independent garage owners around San Luis Obispo County. And we talked about it, and we wanted a mechanic. We needed them to teach get the basic education to the mechanics that we need to hire.
Sure.
And then there was an election for new trustees at Cuesta College. And I was thinking about it, but man, I don't have a good education from Norway. I have very little education in the United States, and I better not do that. Well, one day I had a customer come in that he had been on the city council for a few years, and he was up for re-election, and he was a political science instructor at Cal Poly. And I told him that he should have no problem in running for that. Oh, he says, I still have a problem. I said, okay. Well, he says, I don't have your name recognition. And I said, I have name recognition? Yeah. Oh, I have a name recognition. All right. So I filed papers, and I spent $95 and got elected.
To the Board of Trustees.
Huh. So now with the Board of Trustees, we were going through a problem at Cuesta College with the administration out there at that time, too. But with the help of the automotive people in around, we got the curriculum changed around to where we wanted it, and we got hired some people that was doing going, and we got the program going, and it is going real good.
You know, that's that's so inspirational, and I have a comment. But you still teach now? Is it at Hancock?
Yeah. Well, I finally sold my business, and my wife got sick, and we had planned on doing some traveling and after I retired and so forth. And I needed something to do. And then I got a call at the Motormouth show one morning, and they were looking for teachers at Al Hancock. I had my credential. Was old, but the credential. So I went and applied for it, and I got it.
Wow.
So I've been teaching down there for 6 years.
Interesting. I'd like to give a shout-out for community colleges. My dad was a community college teacher for his entire career. And to me, I'd like to see, if I were emperor of the world, the priorities of education in California turned upside down. And by that, I mean, instead of mistreating and underfunding community colleges and giving it more to the state colleges and universities, I'd turn that upside down and put community colleges at the top of the priority list because they give so much for so little. And in particular, I would like to highlight the idea of their role in vocational education, nursing and auto mechanics and welding and other things that are so vital to our career. We all know not everyone is suited for a liberal arts education. And to me, again, community colleges are so vital in that area. I want to talk just briefly as we get close to the end of the show about your service in the Rotary Club of San Luis Obispo. You've been a longtime member. I've been a member for, over 25 years. And one of the things that impressed me in your service there from the day one was the leadership you provided when you were president of the club in the early 90s. And we got this, our club, I came a year later, but 93, and this was, we're talking 92 or so, 91, 92. But you got a letter in Spanish from a Mexican Rotary Club asking for a partnership between our club and theirs, and you gave it to another Rotarian who did speak Spanish, Miguel Espinosa. And that quirky, strange event led to a 25-year-plus partnership with Mexican Rotarians, of which I'm usually the translator for. Do you ever look back on that odd coincidence and how your wisdom and leadership gave rise to something that has given help to handicapped kids, to people who need clean water, seniors who need a decent place to live? Do you ever think about that?
No.
Oh.
No, I mean, that's one of the things is if you are in a club like a Rotary, you get something, that letter, and that's something that did not inspire me.
No.
But I had somebody in the Rotary Club that it was the right person to give it to.
Yes.
You give it to that person, and it blossoms.
Yes.
And I have nothing to do with it. I had some other things that I wanted to do for the club, and I did that.
Well,
and that worked.
You built a beautiful conference and outdoor event place in the pavilion in Laguna Park, correct?
Yeah, right.
Well, I will differ on one point, and that is one of our biggest projects of all time that we're all involved in, you and me and others, Hal Larson, our patriarch sort of in that regard, was to refinish a used Navy bus that is today delivering handicapped students from home to school and back a decade or two after that actually took place. Your firm donated some services about tires and brakes and alignment, correct?
Yeah, well, the Motormouth show got involved in that, and we looked over the bus, and we didn't do that much, but we did some of it because the bus was in pretty good shape when we got it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, well, I think it had ferried sailors back and forth, maybe on a naval base. It wasn't overused.
No, I don't think so. I think it came from up in the Salinas Valley someplace. I think it was an agricultural bus.
Oh, okay, for farm workers.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
International bus, but it had been well treated.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And it's doing great work even today. As we approach the end of this show, how do you sort of see our country going? If you could give leaders, local leaders, national leaders, some advice from the viewpoint of an expatriate, an immigrant. Immigration is a big issue. Do you have one or two words of advice?
Well, I look at the United States today, and they are saying that we are going too socialistic. Well, take a look at the Scandinavian countries. Take a trip over there. See how these people live. They are socialistic, and they live very, very well.
Things like childcare, healthcare, education.
Yes. And the thing is that, you know, thinking about all the national treasures that the United States has, their forests, their oil, their minerals, and all their things. For example, Norway, they're taking the oil money. The money they get from pumping the oil out of the ground goes into a national project, a national
fund.
Fund, yes. And they got money in this fund that's going to last three generations. And where's that fund in the United States? Why don't they take and do that instead of give it to the people that are pumping it up?
Right, right. It's a different
take a percentage. Attitude. Take a percentage of it. I mean, don't take it all, but take a percentage of it. That's the difference between capitalism and socialism, but a social democratic.
Right,
yes.
Right, which is probably the more precise word. But Norway is small in population and relatively homogeneous. They're not as big as we are, nor as diverse. And a lot of people will say, oh, that'll never work here because we're too big and diverse.
It can do. It can do it here.
And what do you think needs to happen to make that a reality?
I don't think it's going to have to be actually political in a sense. I think the population has to say it. I think the people are going to have to say that. Enough is enough. Let's do something like this.
Well, this has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Per Matt Matheson, local educator and a business owner. It's been a real treat to interview you, Matt. I'm very proud to consider you a friend. And I learned a Norwegian word today, and that would be god dag.
God dag.
Thank you.
Now we can say goodbye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Today is the last regularly scheduled Issues and Ideas for 2019. Next week, Father Ian Dellinger takes over the show with a special holiday-themed Playing with Food. Before we go, we want to share a quintessential Central Coast experience, traveling through Big Sur on Highway 1. KCBX's Morning Edition host Rachel Duchak recently took a bike ride through the rugged stretch of California's Central Coast on her bike. She brought her microphone along so she could share some of her journey. We hope you enjoy the ride.
In late October, my husband and I took our touring bicycles and packed panniers by train to Salinas. We then pedaled home by way of the Pacific Coast Highway through Big Sur. This Big Sur bike tour stretched approximately 150 miles from Monterey County to San Luis Obispo County and involved about 7,000 feet of climbing and downhill over 4 days. After our first day, covering 50 miles and fixing two flats, we spent the night at Pfeiffer Big Sur Campground because it was close to a great breakfast. One part of the bike trip, road trip experience is eating, which when you are on a bike trip, you are eating a lot. We just had a gargantuan breakfast. I'm laughing. We ate every last, I think there was like 2 pieces of potatoes left. But you got to feed the machine. We have huge breakfasts so that we are ready to climb these hills. So we're sitting here under the trees at Deachins. You can hear some of the cars going past. Getting ready to climb back on the bike, fully fueled. roll down the street towards San Luis Obispo County.
So we just passed the Mud Creek Slide, which I'd been hearing about on the news, and my goodness, that is a very big slide. Huge. And if you've been reading in the news about how big that was, they are not kidding. I spend a lot of time in my what's called the granny gear, smallest gear for climbing these hills. We set off this morning by 8 o'clock from Pulaski Creek Campground so that we could tackle this gnarliest section of the ride without as much traffic. Sunday afternoon, people coming home from their holidays. It's always nice when there's not as much traffic, so we're here riding this morning, trying to get out in front of it, slowly. Been trying to remember where what I'm calling Heartbreak Hill is on this ride, and I remembered it's today, where you climb on your bicycle, and you're getting up to what you think is the top of the hill, and there's another top around the corner. And I think there's actually another one after that. And then it's downhill. You have a chance as you're pedaling slowly uphill to see this cool rock work. This used to be a rinky-dink road up into the 50s. It's still pretty rinky, dinky. On our first couple rides, couple days of riding, when we reach a overlook, sometimes there's cheering. That's always nice from our neighbors. Have some quick, funny small talk. The man looking for condors. The two men who were coming up to celebrate the younger one's birthday. Road trip, have a fun, short, quick chat and a laugh. It's one of the nice things about road traveling this way.
Just a few minutes later, a tourist on the side of the road with his phone out flagged us down to show us the photos he'd been taking.
Today's gonna be a hard day.
Look, well, I taken some photos.
Oh, that's great. Nice, nice.
Thank you.
Have a good one. We are definitely in people's phones and videos after this trip. Road construction on the Highway 1 through Big Sur is some of the gnarliest road construction in the state, for sure. It is dangerous, it is expensive. It's got a great view, but it is not easy. The state and the federal government have indicated that they are not interested in closing this road. So they work to keep it open. There are businesses along this road that rely on the tourism and the travelers. I appreciate this road being together, being fairly smooth. One strategy for doing these large hills is to break them up, find a place that's relatively flat, maybe in the shade if it's sunny, and take yourself a little break. And then just keep going up thousands of feet. It's probably hundreds, but it feels like thousands. We're both dressed in bright colors today. Visibility is key. This is the point of the bike tour when you start calculating in your head what you could have left behind, how you're going to swap out that metal travel mug for something lighter. Did you really have to bring the metal spoons from the kitchen? for oatmeal, or was there a lighter option? That's what I'm thinking about as I climb Heartbreak Never-Ending Hill. How fast are we going? Well, when I'm going uphill, it's about 3 miles an hour. Not very fast. Downhill, I'm in the 20s, maybe 30, but I got a full bike and I'm old, so I'm trying not to go too fast downhill, but that is the payoff. Definite payoff on a bike tour through Big Sur for the downhill. So to train for this ride, we did a approximately 15 mile Turi Road ride. We also did a 18 mile ride from our home up to Cayucos. And we went to Riddell's Smokehouse as our destination. It's a fun thing for bicyclists to do is to go to some place to eat. Perhaps you're sensing a trend. Because you burn so much energy riding, you've got to eat. And then when you arrive at your destination, if you are a beer drinker, it tastes really good. It's nice to have a patio so you can keep your eye on your bikes. Because it's hard to lock everything onto your bike. The rest of our training included a 37-mile loop starting in Santa Margarita, Creston, and Werowero Road. That was about 37 miles. We also did a 13-mile hike in the mountains on a quick trip to Olympic National Park for National Public Lands Day at the end of September. So we did just enough conditioning and training to be ready for this Heartbreak Hill. And we're not, and we also planned it so that we knew where we could get food and where we could camp, and we are no longer trying to do 70 mile days. We can do that, but it's less and less fun as you get older to push it that hard. Nice. A lot of downhill just coming up here. Woohoo! Not too steep. Ragged Point!
Been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. We'll be back on Mondays in the new year with more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.